You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday the 24th of December. It's Christmas Eve 2025 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshank, streaming at radioalbion.com. And I do have a guest with me today, especially here for Christmas Eve. I have my good friend and patriotic alternative comrade Euro here today, and he's here to talk about Deep Space Nine, which I really got into when I was in prison. I watched the whole series twice, I think, and I watched the whole series of Voyager, and it was all new to me from season three onwards. So I really enjoyed that, and it's quite fresh in my mind. And I know that quite a few Radio Albion listeners are actually into Star Trek. So I thought it would be good to get Euro on to talk about Deep Space Nine because he's very, very much into it. So Euro, thank you very much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm good, mate. Thanks for having me on. Obviously, you know, you've asked me to come on and talk about something and I suggested the topic. I think it's, you know, to come on to talk about current events for just one show, that's something you kind of want to build momentum with more, whereas this will be evergreen. You know, people can listen back to this and have a little think about it whenever.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I mean, it's always best to have content that can be listened to at any time rather than just current events that does tend to go a little bit stale. And I know Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, I remember you talking to me about this years ago and saying, oh, I really enjoyed it, but I only saw it up to the start of the third season. For some reason, I stopped watching it after that. Maybe I stopped having satellite television, but I certainly did enjoy watching it again. So you think that there's some nationalist ideas that are in Deep Space Nine and reasons why it's better than Voyager. So do you want to start off just by telling us why you particularly like Deep Space Nine better than the other Star Treks?
Yeah, I mean, well, talking about sci-fi generally, if you look at sci-fi historically, it's a very sort of white genre. Obviously, it's looking to the future. It's looking to what our people can create and how we can progress. It's also, you know, through various ways been quite Jewish, like some of the early sci-fi. You had writers like Isaac Asimov and people like that. So there was a lot of Jewish influence in it. I like sci-fi, but I like sci-fi that's kind of grounded. And something I don't like with a lot of Star Trek and certain other things is just like, here's some magic and we'll just call it technology. And I don't really find that interesting, because what's interesting is where you have sort of resource competition leading to conflict. And you don't get that so much, you know, in The Next Generation or even so much in the original Star Trek. What's interesting about Deep Space Nine is it's set on a station, so it's all in the same place. You get a lot of recurring characters. It's all about major political powers sort of vying with each other to get the upper hand, instead of your sort of energy cloud of the week episode. And then it is all about, I dare say, Jews and genocide, starting from the very beginning, with the Bajorans, who are put into labor camps and genocided by the evil space Nazi Cardassians. They're obviously meant to be a stand-in for Jews and Nazis, even though the Bajorans are a kind of settled agrarian population on their own planet, and the others come to them instead of a diaspora people in the other empire. So it's not really analogous in that sense, but the parallels are clear. And then of course, some people will say that the Ferengi are akin to Jewish people. Now, I think that's not a very good comparison, because the Ferengi are very individualistically greedy, and you know, they'd kill their own brother to make money, which I think is not very not very representative of the Jewish people at all. They're in fact very nationalistically socialist within their own group.
Can I just make a couple of points there? I think obviously it was what the creators wanted to sort of put across, is that the Bajorans were similar to the Jews because they were being oppressed, because they were being made into slave labor by the Cardassians. But as you say, that's not a very good parallel, because they're an agrarian people. But it's sort of quite clear that that's what the producers were trying to put across, and they were trying to make it so that the Cardassians were the Nazis.
It becomes more of a colonialist struggle, you know, if you look at it that way. But it's obvious what they were intending.
And also, I think with the Ferengi, the likening them to Jews, it's because they're merchants, aren't they? Primarily they're merchants, and they're driven by gold. But as you say, they're very individualistic. And also, they're very right-wing in their views on women and the way that they treat the women. They're not allowed to do business. And this was a bit of a running joke, is the way that they are, what's the word? Chauvinist. They're very sort of male chauvinist towards the women. So I think maybe they put that in there because they didn't want people to think that the Ferengi were like Jews. So they made them anti-feminist. They made them the sort of opposite of what Jews are actually like. Do you think that thought process might have crossed their minds?
I don't really know if I would describe the Ferengi's treatment of women as sort of in any way right wing. I think that might be stretching a bit. But I think, you know, there's this kind of like, let's call it normie anti-Semitism take, which is just Jews are just evil, greedy money grubbers. And so in that sense, you know, people will be like, ha, 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 look, you know, they're like Jews. But like I said, it doesn't really hold up. I don't think they made them misogynists just to make people think they're not Jewish, if that's what you mean.
Well, no, that's probably the word that I was looking for. But they're almost like right wing caricatures in their misogyny.
They're definitely sort of a caricature of capitalism. And of course, you know, the Federation in Star Trek is like liberals in space. So I think it's very much like a, you know, here's the enlightened liberal Federation who are, you know, to use a particular meme, luxury gay space communism. And then we have like the caricature of capitalism, and oh my God, look how backwards the capitalists are. I think it is as simple as like an anti-capitalist message, not, you know, linking that to a particular racial group, but just an anti-capitalist message. And that's why they made them so sort of, you know, off-putting with all the women stuff and some of the other things they do, to kind of say, like, look, isn't capitalism awful?
Yeah, because I think they're also trying to push this equality thing as well, aren't they? Where you've got like interspecies love affairs, you've got Klingons,
well, do you know what?
Trills.
It's quite interesting. I had some thoughts about that as well, because that's another thing. If you look at, you know, various shows, like, for example, I and a lot of other people kind of find it viscerally off-putting when you have, especially when it's pushed all the time, you have a black guy with a white woman in like every single show or advert. You know, it's not something most people want to see. It's not actually that common. Obviously, it's more common than it used to be because of the way that it's pushed all the time. But it's not actually all that normal a thing. And if you look at, say, Jadzia and Worf in Deep Space Nine, because he's a Klingon and she's a Trill, it doesn't have that same sort of visceral reaction. And you kind of forget that Worf is black, because he doesn't act like a black person. He acts like a Klingon. And of course, he's dark skinned, but you have, like, for example, the guy who plays General Martok, another one of the Klingons, he's a white guy, and they just black him up as part of turning him into a Klingon.
That's quite interesting that because it's sort of two aliens, it's not as jarring to the senses as it is when you see, say, a black male with a white female. There's something about it which is sort of jarring to the senses. But when you see two aliens together, it's not, because the two aliens aren't reality. And I guess we instinctively understand that.
At the end of the day, you have a black male actor with a white female actor. But there's a kind of a level of abstraction there that gets you away from thinking of it in that way.
Because I do think there is there was like a push within it to encourage interracialism. I think in the original Star Trek, the first interracial kiss that there was on television was between Captain Kirk and Lieutenant Uhura. And then later on, when you get to like the later Star Treks, you see that the Worf has got a son who is half Klingon, half human. You've got Vulcan, Spock the Vulcan, who is half human.
And then you've got Valana's half Klingon.
Yeah, and they start talking about the human race, and then they start talking about these other aliens as races rather than as species. So it, like the fact that there are all these different aliens, they're sort of comparing them to just being races. They're all humanoid races, and it's fine for them all to interbreed together. And in fact, I think that even comes up in Star Trek Enterprise, where you get right-wingers that are against this, that are saying we shouldn't have this interbreeding between the races. So it became quite overt by the time we actually got to Star Trek Enterprise.
Yeah. Well, I'd say, like a lot of the old Star Trek, obviously like the new stuff, I wouldn't count anything after Enterprise as canon. You know, like Discovery and Picard, all these ones, I wouldn't count them as you know, true to any of the old stuff. I think Enterprise is kind of on the borderline with some of the stuff they did. It's like, you could count it as canon, but certainly like the new stuff is just so woke and anti-white. It's not even worth considering.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of it because I've been warned against it. So all I've seen is up to Enterprise, and I felt really let down by Enterprise. But the first three, Next Gen, Voyager, and DS9, I think are excellent series.
Well, just to go off on a bit of a tangent here, I mean, you look at Enterprise, and they had this ridiculous plot thread going on about the temporal Cold War, which it does not make any sense. I mean, if anyone has time travel, you'd go back and you'd change things before you could ever have a Cold War. It would be over before it started. So that whole sort of concept is ridiculous. And then in one of the final episodes, the temporal Cold War involves reptilian evil aliens going back in time and kind of helping the National Socialist Germans, giving them various help so that they will then in turn be helped to, you know, build some time travel device to get back to where they're from. It's all very ridiculous, but it's like just another way to sneak anti-Nazi stuff in there.
That was another common theme as well, wasn't it? It was the actual space Nazis. I think they went back to the Second World War in the original Star Trek, and in Voyager you get that bit where I think it's the hunters.
Yeah, the Herosian.
The Herosian,
isn't
that's it?
Yeah, it's actually, thinking about it, it's actually very similar. You know, the way they have the kind of reptilian looking Herosian who are allied with the Nazis. And then in Enterprise, you have the reptilian looking, whatever they're called, allied with the Nazis.
Yeah, I mean, that all does get a little bit cliched. Although I did think the Voyager series, around about that point, it started getting very good with the hunters, the Herosian. Around about that time, I really started enjoying it, especially with 7 of 9. I thought she was a very good character as well. It really did lighten my load when I was actually in prison, because every weekday evening I would get my dinner, and then they would lock me in my cell, and then I would literally have original series Star Trek to watch, Deep Space Nine and Voyager. I had like 3 hours worth of new Star Trek to watch every night, which I really did enjoy watching, like all of it. Even Voyager, which people sort of criticized in the past, but Enterprise
I think Voyager has some good episodes, maybe, but it's very sort of hit and miss. There's a lot of trash in there. I mean, literally you hit the warp, like warp 10 is all of a sudden infinite speed and you become a lizard. I mean, that's just a ridiculous plot device.
I didn't like Neelix very much. I didn't think very much of him. But just to take it back to Enterprise, it was when they had the flying fish tanks in space. And apparently they had evolved to being sentient beings, but they were still fish. And you think, well, how did they evolve welding underwater? How do they make these metal?
Well, I'll tell you what, within that situation, there's five different races which evolve sentience on their planet. So it would be akin to like having humans and some other type of apes evolving sentience, and then also having dolphins who could communicate with us. So kind of in that sense, you could say the other sentient races on their planet shared technology with them that then it allowed them to have ships. But yeah, it really doesn't make sense. You would never have, and this is going back to the point I made earlier about, you know, resource competition, you would never have sort of five sentient races come about on one planet within the same time scale like that, because they would be in competition for resources and it just wouldn't make any sense.
Well, it stretches credibility. I think it stretches the theories of evolution a little bit, just that little bit too far as well.
Yeah.
I just found that was impossible. It sort of went downhill after that. But DS9, I think, was really the high point, and that was the main one that you wanted to talk about. So you were mentioning stuff to do with genocide, because that's a big theme, isn't it? Do you want to talk about that?
I'll come on to that now. So obviously in the beginning you have the Bajorans, who, there are people with funny noses, actually. You know, they look very human, except for some particular ridges on the nose. And of course, as with a lot of Star Trek aliens, it's like human, like most of the aliens of the week are humans with some funny thing on their face. And then you have some races, obviously, like the Cardassians, who are more alien. It goes back to this whole sort of reptilian Nazis thing, because they're the stand-in for the for the evil German Nazis, and there they are, like a reptilian type alien. So, you know, take from that what you will. But obviously, you know, the Bajorans are stand-ins for the Jewish people. They've been put into labor camps, they've been oppressed, they've been killed off, and then the Space Liberal Federation come in to save the day. But later on, you know, and I couldn't sort of give you a number, but obviously a lot of writers in Hollywood are themselves Jewish. So I couldn't tell you how many were involved in writing the show, but they go from a situation of like, here's an allegory for one thing where the Bajorans are the Jews, to creating a race of, you know, what are basically, you know, explicitly said to be evil alien shapeshifters who come from a far part of the galaxy, and they are hell-bent on dominating others, using their shapeshifting powers to take power within institutions in other nations, in other nation states. And their justification for it is that somebody tried to genocide them before who wasn't a shapeshifter. So they must always take positions of power and wield power over the non-shapeshifters, because if they don't, they'll be genocided first. And then, you know, when somebody does go against them, such as when the Cardassians are no longer useful to them, they just turn around and commit the genocide themselves. You know, they're not above that.
Yeah, they don't have any sort of moral high ground, do they? The Dominion. There was one bit where Garak, the Cardassian tailor, he's about to just wipe them out entirely, isn't he? And he starts talking about this to Worf. And you've talked to me about this bit before. You thought this was quite important.
Yeah, well, actually, it's a very interesting part of the show, and I really like that episode. But I actually feel like, you know, obviously, I'm going to have to talk about this carefully, because I feel like talking about Star Trek could lead to a prison sentence in the UK, and you might find that ridiculous. But, you know, if you weren't too careful about what you said, it could. So I'll come on with the quote now. Mr. Garak, who you say is a tailor, but it's well known that he's a spy, and the tailor is sort of his cover. And that's kind of like a reference to various things like Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. You know, this tailor disguise is kind of like a staple of the sort of spy genre thing. But it comes to a point where you have Odo, who is, he is a not evil shapeshifter because he's been separated from his people. And so he doesn't consider himself part of them. But he has to go to the home planet to kind of be assessed and helped, because I think he had some sort of disease and he had to go back there to be healed. Sorry, I had to mute for a second there. So he goes back to the home planet, and then Garak is on board the ship, and he says, well, you know, basically, we should take this opportunity to wipe out these people because we can, and if we don't do it now, they will do it to us. So, you know, the quote is, Worf the Klingon catches him in the act, and he says, come now, Mr. Worf, you're a Klingon. Don't tell me you'd object to a little genocide in the name of self-defense. Now, of course, some people will say that, you know, genocide can never be in self-defense. But looking at it through the lens of the show, it is exactly the mindset of the shapeshifters. That they explicitly say that somebody tried to genocide them in the past, so they must dominate and they must be in control and they must be able to, you know, wipe out anyone else who threatens them. And then later on, they actually, you know, they don't completely kill off, but they do kill off large numbers of Garak's people. So if he had wiped them out there, he might have actually prevented that from happening. Now, I want to be very clear, although we are saying this is an allegory, and I'm relating this to various things about Jewish control, I am explicitly saying I don't think it's justified to genocide anyone, even if you can somehow say that's in self-defense. So we're not advocating that, just for all the people listening. You know, but within the universe, in his situation, it makes sense, because the shapeshifter aliens, they're pretty much a hive mind. You know, with Odo the exception, because he's separated, they actually link their physical presence and their mind to each other in such that they are of one thought and one purpose. So it's not a case of individuals and, you know, some may be for or some may be against. They're pretty much, you know, of one mind that they need to do certain things, and if that involves genocide, they will. And it's only through sort of divine intervention later on in the show that, you know, other all-powerful aliens stop the masses of fighting aliens coming through, that the good guys are able to survive.
I was just going to say another point that comes up with Star Trek is this promotion of traitors to their own people. There are always sort of Klingon traitors that support the next generation, that sort of support the Federation. And what you've got there actually is Odo is actually a traitor to his own people. And he prefers the company of the Federation and all the peoples of the Federation rather than his own people. And it does actually show you how difficult that actually is for him. Do you know what I mean?
Which is rare. I did think about this, but I think it's deliberately not clear cut, because his own people in the show are shown to be pretty much objectively evil and willing and able to carry out genocides themselves. He is being, by all measures, thinking to a phrase that various people have used. You know, like a traitor to one group is a friend to humanity. You know, he is a traitor because he wants to do the objectively good thing of stopping one people genociding another.
But is that objectively good though? Because what about his own people? His loyalty surely should be to his own people. The other people group or the other alien group can look out for their own interests.
Well, I get that, but it comes down to, as I say, this is why it's complicated. If you had, for example, let's say the Federation and the Romulans and they were fighting each other, it's never sort of said in the show that they have any sort of genocidal intent. Obviously, they want to be the ones in charge and ruling over each other and have that power, but they're not trying to physically destroy the other people in whole or in part. Whereas Odo's own people show genocidal intent. So you could view him being a traitor to his own people as a sort of product of not wanting to be involved in a genocide. So I don't think you can be clear cut and say, you know, Odo's just a traitor and therefore bad because he's doing it to strangely enough, he's doing it to prevent a greater evil. And there's a lot of that going on, you know, linking that back to the thing with Garak. He's saying, I'm going to commit, you know, what would be, a terrible thing, the genocide of one group of people, to prevent a greater evil, which would be the genocide of my own people.
Just like a sort of question between two evils, isn't it, really? And determining which one is the most evil. But if you were part of the Dominion, you would think that the most evil one was wiping out your group. That's why I think it's subjective.
Yeah.
But Odo is sort of thinking in the way that the Federation do, rather than thinking in the way that his own people do. There are parts in it where he's really sort of quite uncomfortable because he's not with his own people. You know, because he can shapeshift and the Solids can't. And when he meets somebody from his own people, that was quite interesting as well. And he's sort of evolved in a completely different direction to Odo. And he's become far more like the original Dominion. He's very, very anti the Solids. But there's a very funny line when they're on the promenade and they're doing a Changeling Pride demonstration when they're turning themselves into fog and freaking out the Deep Space Nine residents and Quark Le Ferengi talks him down from it and says this is no time or place for a Dominion pride demonstration, which I thought was probably the best line in the whole series. Very, very funny.
Yeah. But so it's I think very deliberately not a clear-cut thing, because in the show, the Dominion, the Founders, the Shapeshifters are shown to be kind of objectively evil. There's not much to humanize them. There's not much to show you that they are a good force. They are an objectively evil force.
Do you think they're supposed to be like the Nazis? Do you think that's the... Because they're a unique evil, there's nothing good about them. Do you think they're supposed to be the Nazis in it? They started off with it being the Cardassians, and then over time they thought, we'll make the Dominion in it?
That's the thing. I don't think they... I mean, I might be wrong. I don't think they were meant to be a stand-in for the Nazis. I mean, certainly, Death of the Author, you can take what you like from it and choose to interpret it in any particular way. But as we say, in terms of these are literal shapeshifters, and we can look at, you know, it's often said about Jewish people, they're sometimes called shapeshifters because they take on other identities. Although they are a sort of Middle Eastern people with various branches. So the Ashkenazis are interbred with Europeans to some degree, but they do cluster sort of somewhere between Europeans and Middle Easterners genetically. They can sort of pass as white to a degree. And this allows them to come into power structures where they may otherwise be excluded and to take power sort of by stealth. So in that sense, you know, you could liken this and you could say it's kind of an allegorical literal shapeshifter in the way that some Jews are accused of shapeshifting to mean changing identity and hiding their own sort of ethnic background. I don't think it really makes sense as kind of like a Nazi standing at all, but you know, maybe I've missed something.
Maybe they intended it because they were uniquely evil. I think it was completely unintended, like the analogy with crypto Jews. I don't think that was the way they intended it to be understood at all. I think that's just completely unintentional, like a coincidence.
Clarify. I don't think they intended them to be an allegory for the Jews, although we can certainly draw parallels there. But I also just don't think they were meant to be an allegory for the Nazis in the way that the Cardassians obviously were.
Right. I was just thinking of because they're uniquely evil, and they do claim Hitler was uniquely evil, the most evil of the most evil. And it's like there's nothing really... nothing really positive about the Dominion at all. They do like to see themselves as gods, and I don't think Jews sort of do that, do they? They don't want to be worshipped as gods. I mean, perhaps
Jews don't want to be. Well, I mean, you may look at quotes from some people and see that certain Jews do want to be worshipped, if not as gods, then as God's chosen people. I mean, that's a label that they've laid out for themselves. That they're special, that they are better than others. And certainly there's a degree of condescension amongst certain people of Jewish background for anyone who is not of their ethno-religious group, in a similar way to the shapeshifters in the show that look down on anyone who's not a shapeshifter because they're just better than everyone else.
I mean, it has to be unintended, doesn't it? Because there are so many Jews involved in the writing of it. I can't see that them sort of deliberately doing that. Maybe subconsciously they did that, and they sort of projected that out onto the Dominion without thinking about it.
Yeah,
it certainly wasn't intended.
Exactly. So I don't see it as intended at all. But like I say, I mean, you look at it, we start off with the obvious Nazi parallels with the Bajorans and Jews. And then here's the evil alien shapeshifters from the far part of the galaxy. They're obsessed with control. They're obsessed with dominating others. Their excuse for it is that somebody tried to genocide them, so they have to take power to prevent the non-shapeshifters who are beneath them from genociding them. And then they're willing to genocide others first to maintain their power. And they even they use other races as golem. So within Jewish mythology, there is this idea of the golem, which is something they create to defend them, like a mythical being made out of mud or stone, a mud golem, which will fight for them, but in the end it turns against them. So in the show you have the shapeshifters, they make deception through war, shall we say. I think that's the phrase of the Mossad, isn't it? Through deception, you make war. So they're not very much about fighting battles directly themselves. They use other races as cannon fodder, and people they have uplifted who didn't come to that sort of position of power themselves. They have uplifted other races like the Vorta, they have uplifted, and then they have created the Jem'Hadar as a golem. And they keep them under strict control with these drugs. So they have drugs that they literally can't survive without them. And then they instill this, like, well, let's, you know, to use another allegory here, like kind of like philo-Semitism, in a similar way that, you know, some people who would call themselves Christians look up to Jews as sort of morally superior to them. You have these golem, which the founders, the shapeshifters in the show, have created. They look up to them as gods, and yet they still don't trust them. They have to control them through physical means, which in this case are drugs. But you can imagine in some sort of other scenario, you may have a populace which is controlled by financial means.
They were a really horrible race, the Vorta. Horrible, sleazy, slimy, creepy, dishonest. And the Jem'Hadar, I think, were better than the Vorta, but it's certainly an original idea to have a race of aliens that rely entirely on a drug, and they have to have this drug pumping into them all the time, otherwise they're going to die. So it's effectively an army of crack fiends that happen to be like really, really strong and really, really violent and superb military fighters.
Yeah.
And it's a very original idea.
You said the Vorta are unlikable because the Vorta are kind of they're bred and created to be kind of like diplomats and functionaries. They have to be able to lie and sort of hide certain things. Whereas the Jem'Hadar, because they're created to be fighters, that's kind of what they want to do. And within that paradigm, they're shown to be quite honourable, you know. So they're sort of more worried about fighting and winning the fight than they are about trying to trick anyone over. And at certain points, you know, they even sort of do things where, you know, it's like, well, the battle's over. So we'll just, there's an episode where they just march. They know that they're going to die under commands from this Vorta because they're out of the drug. And he just tells them, right, march into this valley where you're in a crossfire and going to like easily die from the Federation. And they just do it.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting episode, that, isn't it? And they choose to do it as well. They warn them and they say, look, you know, you're going to be marching to your death. Like, well, that's the honourable thing for us to do. That's our honour. We obey the Vorta.
Yeah.
There's nothing else that we can do. That's sort of what we were bred for. I'm trying to think of some of the other characters in it. We've done the Cardassians, we've done the Ferengi, we've done Worf and Jadzia, we've done the Bajorans. Is there any other particular aliens in there or parts of the plot line that you want to bring up?
Well, yeah, I think actually something as it relates to the whole thing with the sort of genocide and the ends justify the means. So the humans are the space liberals and the good guys, obviously, in the show. And they have an episode where there's a kind of hidden intelligence agency within the Federation that they kind of don't accept. They pretend it's not real. It's like the CIA, but nobody even knows it exists. And so they're going and doing, again, sort of like ends justify the means things. Well, you know, this is not really allowed to kidnap people and, you know, commit assassinations. But we have to do it because the greater good is protecting the Federation and protecting space liberalism. So we have to do that. And there's a whole thing about, you know, like the Federation aren't like this. We aren't like this. We're better than this. You know, this is what separates us from the bad guys because we don't do things like this. And in I think it's literally the very next episode. And I don't know if this was deliberate or, you know, or not, just something that came about. But the literal very next episode, you have the commander of the station, Sisko, not acting as part of this intelligence network, but acting kind of purely on his own volition, sets out to bring the Romulans into the war against the Dominion, knowing that he's going to have to lie to them and possibly, you know, be involved in some deadly dealings in order to get them into the war. So he goes about and plots with Garak to kind of fake evidence that the Cardassian and Dominion are going to attack the Romulans. And as part of this, it becomes like a, you know, a tangled plot line. And it's shown to be, it's like one of these meme things from the show where the Romulan goes, "It's a fake," you know, because he reads the data crystal and is like, this is obviously not real. So Garak kills him. And then when the Romulans find, you know, the blown up shuttle and the data rod, all of a sudden they think, well, yeah, there's some faults with the video, but that's because it's been blown up. So actually, it's true. And Sisko comes to him and says, like, you planned this all along. You were always going to murder this guy, you know. And Garak says, well, no, actually, I hoped that somehow it would work, but I had this backup plan. And at the end of the day, you know, all it's taken is like one criminal who we literally spared a day from death row execution in the Klingon Empire, one criminal, one Romulan senator, and your conscience, and we might have literally saved the whole Alpha Quadrant, you know, billions and billions and billions of people from slavery and genocide at the ultimate evil. And yet you're mad at me. You came to me because you knew I'd be willing to do things that you're not. But now you're mad at me because we've won. But really, it's a small sacrifice for the greater good.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept there. It's like the Starfleet promotes all these ideals, but what they're saying with that, I think it's Section 31 or something like that. What they're saying is, in order for you to be free to follow all these ideals, we have to break these ideals in order to keep you safe. And it is saying that the end justifies the means, and it's saying that society might have all these morals and the way that we're supposed to be, but that's just for the citizens. When it comes to national security, then all those rules can be broken. And that seems to be what it's saying, which, again, you don't really often get that. And I think that's maybe a commentary on the way that the world is today. We're told that we need to be one way, and yet we see that our politicians and our states get involved in another way. They'll talk about being anti-war while at the same time dropping bombs on Iran. That sort of thing, where you're told one thing, but what you're actually seeing is something different. So, yeah, that was an interesting point there. Was it Section 31 that they were called? I can always remember thinking they were very interesting.
Yeah, Section 31. It's a strange name. But
yeah, and that's another theory that runs through it. And also Julian Bashir. Also, I mean, he's an Indian character, but I can remember when I first watched it, I wasn't... I didn't understand race at all. I thought that he was a white.
No,
character.
I think he's sort of pale enough, and he passes as white in the show. He's certainly when you see his parents, it's funny because when you see his parents, they come in a later episode. They're noticeably darker.
Yeah, they're both Indian, aren't
than
they?
He is.
Yeah, they're both Indian.
Well, you say Indian, but I think perhaps the actor is actually some sort of Arab. I mean, Bashir is not like a Indian, is it? Bashir would be like a Arab word, I think, like Bashar al-Assad. I think it's related to lion, if I'm not mistaken.
There was another thing that we haven't touched on. I mean, that was the one with the black captain. That's what people will remember as being the one with the black captain. But it's not, I thought he was fine. He was actually sort of well cast.
Talking about Sisko?
Sisko, yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's quite good.
He's quite a good character.
Do you know what I find interesting? Obviously, there's a couple of episodes. Like, there's one where he's going through some sort of fever dream, and it might be related to the wormhole aliens, where he's literally back in time, and you know he's being oppressed for being a black guy, and he's just trying to write science fiction stories. And obviously, that's a bit, you know, a bit of a stupid episode, but. What is quite interesting is to contrast him to the other Star Trek captains. So, for example, you look at someone like Picard. He's like a philosophical white guy, and he'll do his little monologue and talk about this, and here's why we're morally right. And, you know, you have an alien who has absolute power over him, like the Q alien will come and basically threaten to wipe out humanity, and there he is, you know, having this conversation about why we should be allowed to live. And then you have, you know, probably not intentionally, but the one guy who happens to be, you know, the black commander captain figure before the kind of modern woke era is the quickest to anger and the most willing to use his fists, and the deity space alien who could wipe out all of humanity with a click of his fingers comes along and tries to torment him in the same way he does to Picard, and Sisko just punches him in the face. And Q says, Picard would never have punched me. But you've got to think, you know, he's got that sort of power. Surely it didn't hurt. It just shows like a difference in mentality. And again, I don't think that was something that was meant to be, you know, picked up on, that was sort of intended as a statement on racial differences. But here is your, you know, your black commander in the pre-woke Star Trek era, and he just so happens to be the quickest to violence and getting angry all the time at various goings on.
Yeah, it's sort of quite realistic. And after that, I mean, so you had the black captain, and then after that you had the female captain, who was a bit like the schoolmistress in space. But I quite enjoyed Voyager, and I thought, well, she did show a feminine side. And she did show that in order to sort of be this captain type, she had to sort of take on a different role to who she actually was, because who she actually was this quite sort of romantic female. When they wiped her memories of being on the starship, and she had that sort of relationship with that guy there, and she was working in the factory, and she wasn't interested in any of that stuff. You know, it was like that was just a role that she was having to put on, which I thought was quite interesting. You wouldn't get that today. It would be that she was like that all the time, and she's just as tough as any man. But she is actually quite feminine in a lot of respects, which I thought was done quite well. I mean, it shows you her sort of pastimes. Her pastimes are living out romance novels. You know, very 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 feminine thing.
Yeah.
She literally
falls in love with a hologram at one point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
but yeah. The thing with Voyager, again, there were some good episodes, but a lot of the writing was trash. And then you have, you know, Neelix is described as kind of the Jar Jar Binks of Star Trek. He is just like such an unlikable character, and then. You know, and another thing that has become like kind of a meme within our circles that I've seen from Voyager is the Neelix character is making a sort of woke criticism of the prison population of some area that they're going through. And he's like, you know, we're going through this sector of space, and there's a group of aliens here that are just like 13% of the population, but they take up 50% of the prison space in this sector. And Tom Paris just goes, maybe they commit more crimes. Give me my food, yeah. Cook. You know,
you did get sort of uplifted to this really important position in the crew, and all he, morale officer or something, and all he did was cook. And you think, well, surely the replicator is going to be better than having to get rid of all the fumes from the gas, and to have like a flame going there and a cookery going there. I mean, it's almost Stone Age compared to the way that the actual ship is. I did find Neelix very annoying, and I can remember being quite pleased when he lost his lungs in the first episode. He's sort of gasping I've lost my lungs. They're giving some fake holographic ones.
Yeah. I was just going to say, like, they do kind of, yeah, in like the Next Generation, that obviously they like, it's magic, you know, here's our magic technology, the replicator. And then I think at some point, actually in Deep Space Nine, they meet people, and they're just like, you know, we grow real food, because, you know, the replicated stuff just doesn't taste as good. And they say basically that replicated stuff is a bit of a pale imitation. And they have this thing obviously called synthahol, which is, I don't know if it's meant to taste like real alcohol, but like doesn't get you drunk or whatever. But then they say that replicated food is kind of like built to a pattern. And it doesn't taste right. It's kind of like, you know, you get that fake meat that's made with mushrooms. You know, there's just something off about the texture. Yeah, something like that. So it's like, yes, it will feed you, and you'll never go hungry. But it's just not quite the same. And yeah, with Voyager, I think, you know, like as I say, one of the things with Deep Space Nine that made it interesting was resource conflict, and you can't just replicate everything. And they kind of failed with Voyager to make it interesting in the sense that here we are so far away from home, we don't have this, we don't have that. And yet you don't see them really struggling for things in the way that they should be. And I think that would have made the show a lot more interesting if they had a bit more going on of like, you know, we can't manufacture this, we need to trade for it, we need to do that. We need, and then maybe if they had a bit more, obviously the thing, I think the thing with the Borg was a bit silly because again, they created, instead of making a moral quandary where it's where, okay, like in order to save the crew from eventual starvation due to lack of power, we'll trade some technology, which then might be used in a war. You know, that would be a bit more questionable. But instead, they help the Borg, who again are like the objectively evil aliens, and yet they just help them. And I think they kind of made it like too black and white that wasn't really a good thing to do, whereas they could have made it more nuanced.
I did find that interesting, actually, the way that the Borg came into Voyager and the way that it built on the various other episodes that had the Borg in them as you gradually learn more and more about them. And they're like drones. And when you find out about Seven of Nine's parents and how they were studying them and walking around them on the ship and sort of masking themselves from them. I did find that very interesting, that arc, as it goes all the way through.
It's also like really stupid that they put themselves and their own daughter in that sort of danger. And it's like,
yeah, bad parents.
I really don't like.
Very bad parenting.
Well, no, very bad parenting. But something I don't like about a lot of American TV shows is like really dumb characters, and it's like a really dumb character gets themselves killed doing something stupid, and I'm just like, okay, good, I have no sympathy for this person whatsoever, you know, because they've like done it to themselves.
Yeah, it was interesting though with the Borg in there and the Hirogen, the hunters that we've mentioned before, and there was another race of aliens in there that were sort of looked like potato heads, and they weren't very bright. And they were sort of stealing technology. I thought they were quite interesting as well. They turned up in the later episodes. And there was another one that was just dumping waste everywhere. So environmentalism started to come in. The climate change stuff, that started to come in Voyager. And also the political correctness and the feminism. But then it wasn't until Star Trek Enterprise that they really hit it with the sort of anti-right wing, anti-nationalist propaganda. I think with that story about the half Vulcan, half human child, and the nationalists were trying to prevent this from happening. And of course, they were extremely violent and they were terrorists and all the rest of it. And I think by that point, I mean, you pointed this, I think it was you that pointed this out to me. They'd stopped using fist fights as well in Voyager, and they would stop punching with the fist because they didn't want to people to emulate what was on the television. So they would give them like a soft palmed slap around the back of the head or push them or something.
They did this one thing, particularly on Voyager, that I remember, where they interlocked both hands together with their fingers. And then they did like a two-handed hammer fist with the two hands together, which would be probably like the most ineffectual thing. It, like even just doing a one-handed hammer fist straight down, you'd be able to get a lot more power than, you know, putting two hands together, because you just can't get leverage in the right way. But yeah, it's kind of like, oh, we can't even show this minimum level of violence on the TV. You know, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, it's like, heaven forbid that some child should learn how to defend himself from watching people punch each other on TV. I mean, that's the other way of looking at it, isn't it? Is you're not teaching kids how to defend themselves. It's not, they're going to see someone punching somebody on television, I think, well, I'll try that out on someone. You would use that in the defensive capability, I would have thought.
And the sort, let's be honest, the sort of kids who are sitting around watching Star Trek, I don't think they're going to be, you know, the type that you need to worry about them starting fights, punching someone the way they saw it done on the telly.
One thing I didn't realise is how old it is. I mean, it goes back to the 90s. I thought it must have been early 2000, but it wasn't. It was 90s. Next Gen, Voyager, and DS9 were all 90s TV shows. And yet they still stand up watching them today. It's still very enjoyable to watch them.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's actually like a lot of crossover in the show. So at some point, obviously, in the very first episode of Deep Space Nine, you have Picard turn up, and the backstory for Sisko, the commander on Deep Space Nine, is that he was literally in the big fight against the Borg, and that he fought directly against Picard when Picard was taken by the Borg and turned into a Borg when he was Locutus, and he like directly blames Picard for being turned into a cyber zombie and killing his wife.
One of the great shames about it is that it wasn't filmed in widescreen. I think Enterprise was filmed in widescreen, but Deep Space Nine wasn't. I don't think Voyager was in widescreen either. It's a great shame that it's not, because it still looks good today. I can remember first seeing Voyager and seeing the credits and thinking, wow, that looks really good. And yeah, it's still impressive today. I enjoyed watching it again anyway, and I'm sure probably most of our listeners have seen it before. If they haven't, you might want to check out Deep Space Nine in particular, possibly Voyager. I can't believe people haven't seen it, to be honest.
No, I've got a bit of weird praise for Deep Space Nine as well. It might not be something that you consider generally, but it's very good sound design. By which I mean it's a very sort of flat audio level all throughout. There's a lot of shows that you get that have, like, you know, all of a sudden you get the massive explosions and you get this going on and whatnot. You can sit down and you can put it on at like a stable volume and you don't have to adjust it. It's actually very good if you want to like fall. If you're one of those people who has to watch something to fall asleep, you can put it on because it won't jar you awake with random noise.
I used to like the engine hum from the Enterprise. I used to have the TV going through my hi-fi system, so you could hear the engine hum in the background. I used to like the theme tune as well. Yeah, I used to be very much into Star Trek. Is there anything else you want to bring up then, Euro, before we finish today?
Yeah, well, actually, I've been watching for another sci-fi show recently, and I've never watched for it before. But I've just started recently, which is Babylon 5.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you've ever watched that.
Yeah, I used to really enjoy that. Grandpa Dan really enjoyed it as well. And I was talking to him about this a while back, and I was trying to find episodes of it online, and I couldn't find any because I would like to watch that again. It used to be on about 11 o'clock at night. And yeah, I used to really enjoy that. But again, I don't think I saw the last two seasons of it for some reason. So yeah. So what do you make of that then?
Well, do you know what? I was quite not surprised exactly, but starting to watch it, there was a lot more Jewish stuff than I realised. And you might think, you know, like a sci-fi show that's not even set on Earth with a bunch of aliens, you know, how can there be much Judaism in that? And I'm not even talking sort of allegorical, like in the way that we're saying with Deep Space Nine, where we can relate something to that. But they have like one of the main cast of characters, like I'd say there's like four or five main characters who are in every episode. And one of them is a quote unquote Russian. But then all of a sudden her dad dies and the rabbi comes to visit. And it turns out she's a Russian Jew. And then you have... One of the other alien races gets into a conflict where they're being genocided by, I think, a group that's meant to be a kind of stand-in for the British. They're an empire in decline who are, like, pining for their old glory days, and the ambassador wears a uniform which is akin to a sort of Nelson's naval uniform, if I'm not mistaken.
Is that the one with the hair?
Kind of meant to be a
like hair that stands out. Yeah.
Yeah. So he's, you know, one of the baddies, And then you have the sort of lizardy type aliens who are, you know, being genocided. And one of them comes out and says, you know, there's also a group of humans for whom never again holds special significance. and just things like that. And it's like, was that necessary? Do you have to make everything about that?
500 years into the future?
Yeah. Yeah, it's literally 500 years into the future. Like and, not even one of the humans, but one of the aliens comes out and says, like, I've been looking into your history. And, you know, this is just like what the Nazis did to the Jews.
You do have to put the Nazis in there all the time. They have to put the Nazis in there in science fiction. Well, I think that was very enjoyable, Euro. I think listeners will enjoy that. Thank you very much for coming on today, and Merry Christmas to you and your family. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you and Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. Merry Christmas, God bless, and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.